Tomorrow is National Hunting and Fishing Day, which is an actual thing in case your spouse raises an eyebrow when you share that little nugget of glorious information. It's always a fourth Saturday in September kind of thing, which I'm sure is by design. Across the lower 48, a lot of states are just beginning to get serious about hunting. Here in Alaska, we're almost on the wind-down side of things, as far as fall hunting. Moose is over and caribou is about to move into a sort of hiatus until we get enough snow to make winter hunting viable. If we get enough snow. Even so, the end of September seems like a dandy time to recognize this day, as it's normally pretty darn good fall weather, a magnificent harbinger of the hunting mindset. Frankly, I like to think that every day can recognize these two activities in some way, if you put your mind to it and use a bit of imagination. Even so, with tomorrow being the actual day, that seems like a right fine opening to talk about National Hunting and Fishing Day. Welcome to Bristol Bay Field Notes. I'm Terry Fuller, Education Specialist for Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. I sometimes get folks on our Facebook page who scoff at or question the compatibility of refuges and hunting. I believe they are confusing refuges with a wildlife preserve or some such thing. In fact, hunting is compatible to the point of, it's in writing. Refuges, where the needs and concerns of wildlife are met, are managed to allow public use. And six particular uses have been identified: hunting, fishing, wildlife observation, wildlife photography, environmental education, and interpretation. These were established to ensure that these uses receive enhanced consideration over general public uses within the refuge system. In Alaska, hunting and fishing receive double consideration, so to speak, because not only is hunting an identified use, but Alaska refuges are also managed with an eye towards subsistence use. And the two biggest subsistence uses of our wildlife resources is those two, hunting and fishing. In light of that, a day to celebrate hunting and fishing seems spot on for folks across Southwest Alaska. A lot of people across our nation make use of refuges. We just happen to live in a corner where hunting and fishing are at the forefront of those uses. Some examples of others might include mountain bikers, hikers, geocachers, ATV riders, rafters, snorkelers, bird watchers, backpackers, berry pickers, mushroom pickers, wildlife photographers, and kids of all shapes, ages, and sizes. To some degree, we have some of those here as well, but the signature activities remain hunting critters and catching fish. For those that have a dim view of hunters, in particular, and not that it's likely much of an issue around here, the truth is that hunters are amongst the most fervent of conservationists. Theodore Roosevelt, the founder of the National Wildlife Refuge System, is memorialized for what he did for conservation, and outdoors men and women also remember that he was a dedicated, passionate hunter. In a civilized and cultivated country, wild animals only continue to exist at all when preserved by sportsmen. The excellent people who protest against hunting and consider sportsmen as enemies of wildlife are ignorant of the fact that in reality, the genuine sportsman is by all odds the most important factor in keeping the larger and more valuable wild creatures from total extermination. That's a quote from our former 26th president, and his words still ring true today. I'll grant you, hunters also contributed to bad stuff before we figured out what was what. The passenger pigeon comes to mind, and the bison almost followed it out the door. In my home state of Kansas, during my youth, white-tailed deer were not very numerous, and were pretty much non-existent through a lot of the early 1900s. And the same was true of the beaver. Today's generation of young folks probably thinks that sounds absurd because Kansas is now overrun with both species. Again, solid management and the efforts of hunters and anglers. Some folks get rankled by game laws, but having protections in place makes sure we're going to have a future for hunting. Before the 1800s, there really wasn't any sorts of such things. Pressure on a number of species took a heavy toll on wildlife resources, such as with wolves and bears, at least in the lower 48, and deer, bison, and a number of bird species. The whole refuge system came about due to heavy pressure on large shorebirds along the eastern seaboard. As we moved into the 1900s, enlightened individuals realized that, yes, you can totally deplete a species. And that's when things started to turn. Important laws were signed into being that had an impact on growing numbers for animals that were dwindling in number. Laws like the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918, the Migratory Bird Hunting and Conservation Stamp Act of 1934, the Federal Aid and Wildlife Restoration Act of 1937, and the Federal Aid and Sport Fish Restoration Act of 1950. In fact, the laws passed across the last century laid the foundation for what's called the North American Model of Wildlife Conservation. There are 7 facets to the North American Model, facets that make it distinct from anything else in the world today. First, wildlife is recognized as a public resource, irrespective of the land or water where wildlife is found. Government agencies at various levels have a role in managing that resource on behalf of all citizens and to provide for long-term sustainability of populations. Next, game markets are no more. This was a big part of the declines and sometimes eliminations of so many species in the 1800s, such as market hunting for feathers. Making it illegal to buy and sell meat and parts of game and non-game species removed a huge threat to those species. There are still some markets, such as for fur bearers, but that continues as a regulated activity. Third, wildlife is allocated by law. This refers to legal things, such as seasons, bag limits, and license requirements. Fourth, wildlife can only be harvested for legitimate uses. Wanton waste is not allowed. Fifth, wildlife species are considered an international resource. For example, many types of migratory birds cross national boundaries, so treaties are set up to cover those ranges. Sixth, science is the backbone by which decisions are made. Locally, this is aided by things like the annual waterfowl survey or the requirement to turn in hunt reports. And the last facet is that hunting is for all. Government agencies allocate access to wildlife without regard to such things as wealth, prestige, or land ownership. So, that's where we're at with regards to wildlife and management in our country. Let's go back to tying that to anglers and hunters with some examples of how that's done. One very current example is the federal duck stamp. Through the duck stamp, hunters help protect and restore habitat for migratory waterfowl and other birds and wildlife. The stamp has a much longer formal name, the Federal Migratory Bird Hunting and Conservation Stamp. It's a required thing for waterfowl hunting across most of the nation. I say most because those of us across rural Alaska are exempt during the spring and summer season, though we do need it for the fall statewide season. I just bought mine a couple of weeks ago. It's a great value. For every dollar spent on duck stamps, 98 cents goes directly to purchase or enhance habitat. There's also the Federal Aid and Wildlife Restoration Act, or as it's more commonly called, the Pittman-Robertson Act, named for the legislators who authored it. With this piece of legislation, hunters fund a wide range of conservation programs. The act uses revenue from an excise tax on firearms, ammunition, archery equipment, and other related items to generate revenues to pay for state wildlife agency projects, hunter education programs, and the operation of archery and shooting ranges, to name just a few things. It's a really big thing with regards to conservation efforts, and it's hunters that are picking up the tab. So here's the deal, and this does potentially apply to you directly. We try to celebrate both it and National Public Lands Day, which is also tomorrow, each year with an open house event. Anyone and everyone is invited, if you're in Dillingham. Due to some staff members being out of town tomorrow, we're going to push our open house to celebrate these events back to next week, on Saturday, October 5th. If you're in Dillingham, we'll be open to the public from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. We'll have a campfire going, in a fire pit for the sake of safety. We'll have hot dogs for you to cook, coffee, and possibly some other drinks and snacks as well. We'll also have a number of demonstrations and activities for folks to see and do. Refuge staff will be on hand to answer questions and share experiences and stories, some of which might actually be true. Oh, and did I mention the food and beverages are free? If you're new in town, we're located just above the Bayside Diner. Keep an eye out for wood smoke and good smells. So, if you don't have anything going on next week on Saturday the 5th, stop by and visit with us. We'd love to see you. Come into town for your normal Saturday stuff. Maybe go to the store if need be, pick up your mail, and then drop by our office and help us celebrate two very fine days of recognition. Just a little bit late. For Field Notes, I'm Terry Fuller. Music from Loon Echo Lake provided courtesy of Solitudes at www.solitudes.com.